How do you honor God? By doing everything to the glory of God. Not just not sinning, not just, okay, you don't steal from people, but by making good shoes.
If we're going to talk about you were a new creation, that means everything has to change.
Why does God not just, you know, bring people to heaven immediately after being saved? It's because there's stuff to do here. There's a point to all of this. And if we're Christians, we do it better, or at least in theory.
But if we really apply the standard that's set in Scripture, then we know that no one is good because no one is God.
We serve a storyteller. We serve a God who has a perfect plan, a sovereign will for every moment of history.
It's not about going into the world to make artists. It's about going into the world to make disciples.
Hey, hey, this is The Christian Artist, honoring Christ through creativity. My name is Caleb.
My name is Carly.
And we are here once more to talk Studio Ghibli. So, my camera is slightly off my voice. Let's see if that helps. It does not. Okay, I'm going to restart my camera here, but we'll just keep talking while I do. So we are here, we're going to be talking about Porco Rosso tonight. I'm very excited because I enjoyed the film quite a bit. Continuing our series through the Studio Ghibli films. Let's see. We've gone through quite a few of them at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But we still have many more ahead. What were your initial, just like general thoughts on the film?
It was very different than the rest of them so far, in the sense that this one was very much more of a comedy than any of the other ones.
Mm.
And that was mainly just because of the characters.
Yeah, lots of character humor, for sure.
Yeah. And it, like, surprised me, because that's not really what most Ghibli films are known for. But I think especially upon the second rewatch, I do think this is one of my favorite ones that we've seen so far.
It really held up to
particularly
rewatch,
for the characters. The main female character, Theo, is definitely like one of my favorite Ghibli characters of all time so far.
Yeah. There's a account I follow on Twitter, something Studio Ghibli. I can't remember the exact name of it, but it's a Studio Ghibli like fan account.
Mm-hmm.
And they posted a one of those, like, you know, there's three rows with nine pictures, you know, three pictures in each row, so it's nine pictures total.
And three columns.
Yes.
So nine pictures.
That was the other word I was looking for.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nine boxes.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like the caption was, who's the best Studio Ghibli girl? And I looked at it and I was like, Theo isn't on here. That's the best Ghibli girl. And then the person posted a GIF of Theo in response to it. So I think they just ran out of space. But that was what really told me that Theo had really clicked with me as a character, was when I looked at that and I was like, my best Ghibli girl isn't on here. But honestly, I think best Ghibli girl for me so far would be a tie between Theo and Kiki.
Yeah.
They're both really, really characters.
Great.
Yep.
I think Theo is just, there's more characterization to her in general.
Which is fun because she's actually not the protagonist of this story. So it's actually really remarkable how much character work gets done in this film. And real quick, before we go any further, let's give a quick summary of the film for those who aren't familiar with it. So the, like, little, you know, tag here says, an early 1930s era Italy, air pirates, bounty hunters, and high flyers of all sorts ruled the skies. The most cunning and skilled of those pilots is Porco Rosso. A former ace, he now makes a living flying contract jobs, such as rescuing those kidnapped by air pirates. Donald Curtis, Porco's rival in the air and in catching the affections of women, provides a constant challenge to the hero, culminating in a hilarious action-packed finale. They all, of course, forget to mention in this little intro that Porco Rosso is a pig.
Yeah. He's a man that somehow was turned into a pig.
An anthropomorphic pig, so he's not, like, actually a pig, but yeah. It's funny. You think that would, that's be what you start with in summary. But yeah, really, really good character work. Very fun setting. This is one of the Ghibli films that has the most
which is funny, the most like reality to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like even Kiki's is set in like an alternate history.
Yeah.
Even though it's Earth, and you know, Pompoko is technically on Earth, but it's like all about forest spirits. Mm-hmm. But like, so this one really feels like everything in this movie could have happened except for the fact that he's a pig, right? That's the only thing that's actually like fantastical about the story. So it feels very grounded. Throughout most of the film, him being a pig is treated almost as a metaphor more than anything, right?
Yeah.
Because at one point he says, you know, like all middle-aged men are pigs, right? Like he's just kind of like, this isn't anything special about me. Like everyone treats it as if he has some sort of curse on him, but to him it's just like, well, of course I'm. It's a metaphor for how he feels about himself. In the
he treats it as just a self-deprecating reality of like, I'm not a good person, so I'm just a pig.
Of course I'm a pig. What are you talking about? Yeah. Really, really fun setting. As we mentioned earlier, Miyazaki, I think we talked about at one of the podcasts before this. I think last one, I think for Kiki's, we talked about this. Miyazaki has a whole bunch of interest in aviation, and this is one of the films that really, like, it's always there in the background in almost all of his films. I think all of his films, actually. I don't think there's a single one of the ones that he, like, Studio Ghibli films in general, there are some, but the Miyazaki films specifically, I don't think there's a single one where a character doesn't fly at some point in the story, right? But this one is definitely, like, you can tell his love of aviation just comes out of it, because it's like the whole story revolves around planes. And as far as I could tell, a very realistic depiction of planes, right?
Yeah. Specifically seaplanes most of the time, which is kind of a cool, like, you get a slightly unique angle on, like, air combat and stuff, because it's like, specifically Porco Rosso, like, he has a seaplane, like, it's meant to glide on the water and take off and land on the water and stuff. So you get a lot of flying over water shots, which is fun.
And
interacting with boats and stuff.
Yep. Yeah, really, I mean, again, beautiful visuals, like usual. With Ghibli. And I mean, I'm not sure there's a whole lot else to say about the setting, because it's pretty, I mean, 1930s Italy is pretty much all you need to know. So, you know, the World War I is in the past. People are like recovering / rebuilding after that, and things are moving into what would be World War II, right? So fascist Italy is gaining power, and Porco Rosso at one point has to go to Milan, and he has to like dodge secret police because, you know, he's wanted by the Italians.
And he's getting an Italian mechanic to fix his plane, or basically rebuild his plane. All of the women in the family are the ones building the plane, because all of the men are drafted.
Yeah.
Jobs.
Right. Yeah. Yep. So lots of really fun, like, setting details there. It's pretty straightforward. There's not like a whole lot to discuss in terms of like the fantastical elements of the setting that you need to be familiar with to understand the story. One of the things that I think is interesting in this article that I'm looking at, that I kind of scanned through for Porco Rosso here, this concept we've been talking about of this kind of the way that Japan treats. And I didn't realize how Eurocentric it was, but we were talking about how Japan does a good job of like treating other cultures with respect when they make stories about them, and not making it like, oh, there's a random Japanese people here for some reason. Like, everyone has to be look like me, sort of a thing. But there's actually a word for this, Wakon Yosai, which means Japanese spirit, Western learning. It's a tendency since the Meiji period for Japanese artists to paint Europe as spectacular, while simultaneously maintaining the distance necessary to preserve a distinct sense of Japanese identity. And I felt like that was a pretty good description of what Japanese, like, anime specifically does with these sorts of films. So this film, or like Attack on Titan, right, that deals with like Europe.
It's never trying to make Japanese culture seem like it's less important. Like European culture is the more dignified or the more special. It's just like, hey, we're allowed to portray other cultures and like actually treat them the way that they are, as opposed to like trying to blend our culture into it or make it more understandable to our culture. Like, instead, let's just explain the other culture instead of.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, this article is pointing out that sometimes they can go too far in making Europe seem better than it is.
I'm sure that's possible, yeah.
And specifically, Chris Wood, who's an academic that had some stuff to say on this. I don't know who he is, but this quote from him says, in Porco Rosso, Europe is tamed, renders as a charming site of pleasurable consumption, made distant and viewed through a tourist gaze. I think there is a little bit of tourism that does happen when anime, like, mm-hmm. you know, if when it's like Porco Rosso or maybe like Vinland Saga, I'm thinking, where they like, I'm you know, it's not like they're trying to be intentionally misrepresenting the setting, but it's still like they're still others trying to portray a culture that's not their own. So there's like maybe I think they go the right direction instead of trying to be like, oh, it's terrible,
mm-hmm.
right? We're gonna drag it down. They're going in the right direction and playing up the good things about it,
yeah.
which I think is probably the right instinct when you're trying to be respectful to another culture while like setting a movie or something there.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just thought that was interesting that there's like actually like a it's, you know, it says here at least one scholar has argued that the film's more overt historical references can be understood as representative of Wakan Yosai, Japanese mm-hmm. spirit of Western learning. So. Just interesting, like, I didn't realize there was actually, like, a regular discourse about the stuff that we had already been talking yeah. about with that. So I'm curious, I want to look that up a little bit more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny, because, and I'll have to kind of revisit this after I read the book, but we just recently finished watching The Man in the High Castle.
Mm.
And you can definitely tell that there's a little bit of that in the way that... and again, the show might have done this different than Philip K. Dick initially did in the book. But with the Amazon show, it's clear that like the Japanese who have clearly made the American states that they have authority over in this alternate timeline, subordinate to them in a lot of ways in which like, the Japanese are very racist towards the Americans, but they still have this like reverence for old American artifacts and things from the past that said a lot about their culture. So it's interesting that like that shows up in multiple different things across media. Because it's a Japanese thing. It's not, it's a part of their culture to view Western culture in a certain way.
Yeah. 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 There's, I just recently, watched a video essay, about the way that Studio Ghibli treats, war. And I don't think it's as like the Porco Rosso obviously has stuff to do with that and whatnot, but I think I'm going to wait until I won't go too far into the essay. Cause I think mm-hmm. I want to bring up some things about it, but when we get to, Howl's Moving Castle and, The Wind Rises are the two main films that get picked at in that essay that I think the argument of the essay basically was that, you know, Japan has really good things to say about like, being anti, you know, the horribleness of war and the horribleness of nuclear weapons and all that stuff. But the essay argues that the Japanese often do it in a way that makes them seem like the victims of everything, as opposed to the people who instigated the war in the Pacific, right? Which, you know, there's historical evidence that could be argued that, you know, America was goading them or whatever. There's all sorts of complicated, messy historical realities of that. But it's, I mean, Japan was, the Japanese Empire was horrible in World War II, right? They were evil. They were conquering people, you know, like, they were just bad. Yeah. And so it is interesting to think about And I just bring that up because I want to put a pin in it and come back to it later. When we look at some of those other films that I think deal with that concept a little bit more. Because I've had this video essay on my mind, but yeah, let's move on to plot for Studio Ghibli or for Porco Rosso. Basics of the plot is Porco Rosso is a bounty hunter, and to kind of prove himself as a bounty hunter and retain his position in his job, he has to go head to head against an American ace pilot who might prove to be his downfall, right? Who might prove to be better than he is. And that's basically if you had to boil the story down into a nutshell, that's the plot. There's a lot of character work that's happening behind the scenes that seems to do more of the heavy lifting than that plot. Like his relationship with Fio, his curse as a pig, his relationship with Gina.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea is that he's a bounty hunter. He fights air pirates, right? He has to go against this guy who was contracted by the Sea of Pirates to help, like, take him out. The guy is maybe just as good as he is in the cockpit, and he has to, like, get, you know, rebuild his ship and or his plane and go back and fight him. Lots of really, really fun aerial combat. Again, more like an adventure film than like mm-hmm. a war film, right? This is lighthearted, comical.
It's definitely more like Indiana Jones type vibe.
Yep.
Than like
adventure.
Yeah.
Adventure as opposed to as much action.
Yeah.
I mean, there's certainly plenty of times where planes get shot up and crash and stuff during.
It's also very. I mean, obviously, we've already said it's more. It is more of a comedy. It's an adventure. It also reminds me of like old Looney Tunes. I mean, he's a pig, but like, not because of that, just the way that they, especially there's like a fist fight at the end, and that whole sequence is just so like classic Looney Tunes to me, because they're just knocking each other around and like making snide remarks at each other the whole time, and it's really funny.
For a 1992 film, it does definitely feel more at home in the 1930s or the 1940s.
Mm-hmm.
They did a really good job with the aesthetic, and I think that goes through with the adventureness of it too, right? So like it does feel like Indiana Jones or like a schlock, slush pile adventure fiction, right? Where it's just like the daring, especially with like the American, right? Like he is mm-hmm. a stereotype of almost any American action hero in that era, right?
Yeah.
Lots of like high adventure aesthetics as mm-hmm. opposed to like any sort of gritty war aesthetic. Like Porco Rosso was a pilot in World War I, and there's like a flashback that we get, but even then we don't get the flashback in all of its gory details. It's more like a dream. None mm-hmm. of the really bad stuff actually gets shown on screen. It's more just like a tale he's telling about why he's the way he is and all this stuff. The actual action we get is very lighthearted.
Mm-hmm.
Even with the pirates, right? Like the pirates end up being, all of the pirates end up being friendly by the end of the film, right?
Yeah.
Like even when they're cursing Porco Rosso,
it
never comes off as like real, what the real world would actually be like if this was happening, right?
It's very much a cartoonish, like arch nemesis relationship where like they don't actually want each other dead.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that wouldn't be fun, but
yep.
They just enjoy butting heads all the time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. So we have, Gina, who is, basically Porco Rosso's probably like, longest friend, who runs a hotel for sea pilots. So like pirates will come there and other pilots, and I think, what is that, an island her restaurant is, so it's like mm-hmm. people like
have to go by boat or by plane?
The hotel is elsewhere, but her house itself is like on an island. It's from what I remember. Okay. Like she has a house and a garden that's, I think, separate. I might be wrong.
Nope, it is the same.
It's the same.
Yeah, Hotel Adriano is located on a small island in the Adriatic Sea.
Okay.
Yeah, so she has her garden and gazebo and dock and all that stuff there, as well as the hotel. Interesting. So Gina has married several pilots who have all died. And there's lots of romantic subtext between her and Porco Rosso, but obviously Porco Rosso is a pig, so that would be weird. So there's like that kind of through line happening where Porco Rosso, like she doesn't want Porco Rosso to get killed because she doesn't want to go to another pilot's funeral. And he keeps endangering himself. And then we have all of our favorite characters, Fio, right? Curtis, the American, who's kind of Porco Rosso's arch nemesis in the film, shoots down Porco Rosso's plane and he needs to go get it fixed in Milan. So he heads over to Milan. Because of it being set in 1930s Italy, fascist Italy has like hired or drafted any able-bodied working man, right, in their factories or their soldiers, in the military. And so who has to fix up Porco Rosso's ship? A bunch of gals, right? So,
literally like every woman in their large Italian family.
Exactly. Yep. Yep. And Fio particularly, 17 years old, skilled engineer, who's been like grown up around this all her life with her grandfather, who's, the mastermind behind the business, the airplane repair business. And just a delightful set piece and a delightful character Fio is. I think this film, as with any Miyazaki films that we've come to so far, except for maybe Princess Mononoke, but we'll get to that when we get to it, deals with femininity really well.
Mm-hmm.
Even despite there's a couple of third wave feminist comments here and there about are you just saying this because I'm a woman? But then it'll counter with, I think it was.
Is it because I'm a woman or is it because I'm only 17? Like, because I'm young? And he's like, both. And she was like, well, that's fair.
Yeah. So, yeah, there'll be a lot of counterpoints throughout the film where a comment like that will be countered with a balancing act. And even with the whole the women are building the plane for him, it's just like, well, what else are you gonna do? Like, it's literally 1930s Italy.
And also the main mechanic, the like one guy that's there, is like praying over their like huge table full of women that are all sitting down to eat spaghetti and wine, and is like being like, help us build this plane and everything. And then he very quickly says, like, and forgive us for like building it at the hands of women.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Like, it's clear that like it's the they're not like inserting a modern feminist outlook into the history, like the historical context.
They're just presenting the historical context.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're just presenting the historical context as it was.
Yeah.
Which is great. Yeah, I enjoyed it a lot. Fio's a great character. She is plucky and clever and feels like a 17-year-old girl, right?
Yeah.
Very, I don't know if realistic is the right word, but just like a very grounded, real character with honest motivations, with good flaws and like a good balance of like competencies and flaws and things she can't accomplish, which things she can. A lot of really fun character. I don't know if you have any other thoughts on Fio.
Yeah. I love the fact that she's not like a feminist icon. Like that's not what her character arc is about.
Even though she's an engineer, her main thing she manages to do in the film is the two main things that she manages to do in the film. Okay, let's say there are three main things she manages to do in the film. It's like her three main accomplishments in the film are one, build the plane, right? Mm-hmm. Awesome. You know, not a like a strictly feminine thing, but like, oh well. And then two, we have convince the pirates not to kill Porco Rosso. Mm-hmm. And to do a duel instead, right? To do a one-on-one duel. All feminine, all the way through, the way she does mm-hmm. it, right? She's like, aren't you supposed to be honorable? And like, yep. she's playing into their masculine instincts and doing a great job of manipulating them in only the way a woman can, right?
Yeah.
And then third, this is a spoiler, so we're getting into spoiler season here anyway, but so leave now if you don't want spoilers and go watch the film and then come back. Her third main accomplishment is she kisses Porco Rosso at the very end of the film and he turns back into a human, right?
Wasn't that Gina?
No. No, it was Fio.
Wait, really? I'm not mm-hmm. remembering this right, apparently.
No, yeah, it was Fio. Okay. Yeah, I think you're walking around with Finn at the end of of that scene with her rewatch. But yeah, no, so it was Porco Rosso grabs Fio, puts her in Gina's plane, and the Gina's plane is taking off, and Fio reaches back and kisses him. And then he falls over.
Okay, yeah.
Fio watches him, gets a confused look on her face, and then they fly away. Porco Rosso stands up, he talks to Curtis for a little while, and then Curtis turns to him and says, Your face!
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
And they had joked earlier about the whole, you know, kissing princess kissing a frog mm-hmm. thing.
Yeah.
But I think the implication more than anything is that because of how Porco Rosso talks about Fio, he's like, you make me wish I wasn't a pig. Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Like, and the way he kind of talks about it is as if he has gotten into this rut of being this cynical old middle-aged man. Right. Where he needs to remember the idealism of youth and actually kind of come out of that cynicism, out of his like midlife crisis, right, and come mm-hmm. into like some more optimism and come back to humanity in that sense. And so her kiss is the final thing that seals that deal. Again, I mean, very feminine.
She also, another thing she notably does is she agrees that if Porco Rosso loses the duel to Curtis, that she will marry Curtis. And right, she willingly walks into that and is sure, like, I believe Porco Rosso will win, so I won't have to, but...
yeah, again, very feminine thing to do, yeah. right?
All of the pirates, like, just admire her.
Fawning over her, yeah.
Yeah, they're like, not only is she a great, like, engineer and mechanic on planes, but also she's just, like, she's just a great example of a woman, and it's not ever in like a gross way that any of the men are admiring her, which is something we've touched on a little bit that Ghibli is really good at, is just being like, yeah, men are able to like fawn over a woman in not a disgusting pig-like way. Which is another thing about Marco, which is Porco Rosso's actual name, is that he, the entire time, like, he's never, like, trying to get with Fio. Like, there's several jokes from her uncle of, like, don't touch her kind of a thing. Because, obviously, cause she's 17. But, he's, like, always, she's just, like, a young, like energetic, inspiring person that's like giving him life in a way that like he didn't have anymore. And he's never in like trying to beat Curtis so that she doesn't have to marry him. He's never like, no, you can't have her because I want her. It's always like she's more of a daughter figure for sure. And like, yeah, he wants to protect
it's the
her
idea.
Yeah, it's the idea of Theo more than anything, not the actual, you know, and then he eventually goes to Gina. The implication at the end of the film is that he goes to Gina because they've been having this romantic tension. And it kind of comes back to humanity and gets with her. But it's the idea of Theo more than anything kind of shaking him out of his complacency, which I mean, I really enjoyed and do enjoy in general that storyline of the older man like having to come out of his cynicism by this like beautiful young woman, right? I think if there's like a really beautiful thing there where I'm trying to put it into words here. Porco Rosso at one point says, you know, don't worry, I'm not interested in her. Even just looking at her makes me tired.
Makes me tired, yeah.
Right? But there's an implication there that, like, he's a tired man because he's forgotten things that were important in his his youth, right? And he needs that to, like, kind of remember and keep working, right? Keep going, keep fighting, even when he would much rather just sleep, right? Just be done with all of it, right?
I mean, we see at the very beginning of the film he's just sitting alone on his little private beach where he has like a campsite set up because that's his hideout where he goes when he's not on jobs and stuff, and he's just like sitting in like a camping chair or a, you know, a very very like primitive version of a chair, the word I'm thinking of, just like listening to like the radio and just like drinking a whole bottle of wine. Like you can tell from the beginning that like maybe he used to be something a little more exciting and now he's not.
Yep.
But at the same time, he has a lot of really great, slightly pessimistic but very rational lines where, I mean, you know, the all middle-aged men are pigs, which is clearly like a hyperbole, but and then he's got another one, it's another character that says it, because someone asks like, what's the difference between war and bounty hunting? And they say, I'm trying to remember. It's like, if you can't, like, now I can't remember.
Yeah, let me see if I can Google it. Yeah, here you go. If you make money from war, you're scum. If you can't make money from bounty hunting, you're an idiot.
Because Porco Rosso makes like a clear delineation that like he's not in the business of war anymore. It's like he's just getting paid to do very specific jobs, but he's not interested in being part of a war effort anymore, like he was once. Which is again part of that Japanese anti-war thing, even though he's not a Japanese character, but. He's clearly Italian, but very, very good, like, cynicism about war because he's seen war. Lots of those lines that are really good.
Yeah. And one of my favorite lines, and I think many people's favorite lines from this film, is at one point he gets his old friend from the Italian Air Force tries to recruit him. To come back and work for them, and Mark Porco Rosso looks at him and says, "I'd rather be a pig than a fascist."
Yeah.
So, that was a great line. I'm trying to remember the context of that.
Yeah, because he's trying to say basically, as long as you're in Italy, the Italians are. Like, they have a warrant out for your arrest, basically, and, like, they're, because you deserted the war, and but it maybe if you come back to the army, I can like pull some strings for you and get you off free.
Yeah. I can't find the line he's actually responding to specifically, but it's fine. So I don't think it matters that much. Yeah, and just has a lot of great lines like that. You know, surrounding the metaphor of pigs, but also like the metaphor of war, as you were just talking about, and not metaphor of war, but the reality of war and other things along those lines. Just a really fun film. Like it deals with a lot of heavy themes, but like I think it's a perfectly great film for kids. Mm-hmm. Like unlike even, you know, there's definitely some that I wouldn't show to like young kids, but Porco Rosso is a perfectly fine film to show.
Didn't really like watching all the planes.
Yep. Yeah.
So exactly. He's 18 months old, not even. So, I think one of my favorite things about this movie, which was kind of surprising because you kind of expect any movie that has an aspect of it, like a character that's been magically turned into an animal. You expect that the whole story is going to be about that person turning back into a human and like the curse being broken. And it is implied at the end that it is broken, but that's not what the movie's about at all. Like it is more about his cynicism lightning, which is, you know, part of that metaphor of like him being a pig. But yeah, it's less about the actual physical characteristic of him changing and more about, you know, these characters that he meets along the way and, you know, Gina being there the whole time. That is like, that's what makes the difference. Like, even if he didn't turn back into a human at the end, like it still would have been a great story.
Yeah, I think it's good that he did turn into a human at the end, just because it makes the romance make more sense.
But,
I really like the way that they handled it, like where they never actually show his face. They just hint at it. Yeah. And then they even still just hint at the fact that he got together with Gina. But the pieces are all there and you can, I mean, it's all very, it's clear what the insinuation is.
Yeah, the only time they showed his face was in the like flashback. Like almost
or when he's like a kid
thing. Yeah. Well, he was in the army, but
yeah.
Where he's like in his plane.
No, I'm saying there's two different times where he was a kid at one point. They did a flashback where he and Gina are flying an airplane and then
he's in
war. But neither of them are middle-aged Marco today. Yeah. Right. So yeah. Yep. Yeah. Great film. I really enjoyed it a lot. Highly recommended. I can't think of a single thing I disliked about the film. So, which is not, there's definitely gonna be some films coming up here that will actually hit that don't like as much. So we're going to do next week, in theory, Only Yesterday and Pompoko. Those are the ones we're going to do next week. And then we're going to do Princess Mononoke. And then we're going to do Whispers of the Heart and My Neighbors, the Yamadas. In one chunk again, and then we'll actually be to films we have never seen before. Spirited Away, but after that one.
Yeah, I'm excited to watch that one.
Yeah. I mean, I'm really, there's so many good ones still on the horizon here. We got Spirited Away.
A lot of the really well ones that we still haven't watched.
Yeah. There's The Cat Returns, which I don't know what that is about. Oh, hey. It's a return to, I don't think it's the same characters as Whisper of the Heart, but it's like the same cat statue from Whisper of the Heart. Maybe it is a return to Whisper of the Heart characters. Interesting. I'm curious about that. Howl's Moving Castle. Tales from Earthsea, which I'm interested to watch because Tales from Earthsea is a fantasy novel by Ursula K. Le Guin, which I've been meaning to read for a long time. But I like a lot of people say that the adaptation is very different from the book. But I'm still interested to see.
Isn't that one also directed by his son, I believe?
Tales from Earthsea. Yeah, Gorō Miyazaki.
Yeah. So I was reading a little bit about, and obviously we can talk more about it when we actually get to it, but I was reading a little bit about him and Miyazaki's relationship with his son. And basically after making that movie, it was a little bit rocky because he just kind of thrust it upon his son and was like, here, direct this movie, instead of, and didn't like help him along the way.
Interesting.
And he didn't really have that much experience. So it, some of his inexperience might be people's, some of people's criticism about that one. We'll have to see.
Yeah, it got 38% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Oh, wow.
Tales from Earthsea did. Yeah. I knew it was, I knew people didn't like it as much, but I didn't know it was that bad.
But then so, it'll be interesting once we get to Ponyo, because that one's supposedly like from Miyazaki to his son as sort of an apology for Tales from Earthsea. Interesting. So
that's fascinating.
I'll have to read more about that, but
yeah.
Yeah, so we have Howl's Moving Castle, Tales from Earthsea, Iblar Jakan, which I don't know anything about. It's a 30-minute, like, shorter film with no dialogue. Okay. Wow. Yeah, so I know that that was, like, it's a Ghibli some project, but mm-hmm. I don't know anything more about it. And then we have The Secret World of Arrietty, which I don't know anything about. From Up on Poppy Hill, The Wind Rises, The Tale of Princess Kaguya, and When Marnie Was There. And I think there's like another one that's coming out, right? That he's working on right now.
I don't know. Well, Ponyo should be on there somewhere, right?
Yeah. Didn't I read Ponyo?
I
might have skipped over it since you already mentioned it.
Yeah, maybe. Where does it fall in there after Earthsea?
It's right. It's Tales from Earthsea. Iblar Jakan, the like weird little 30-minute film, and then Ponyo.
Okay, that makes sense.
Let's see if there's any of them that I'm missing here. The Red Turtle, Earwig and the Witch, and The Boy and the Heron, which is still to come. Man, Joe Hisayashi is still doing music for him. That's crazy. He's done a lot of them. Anyway, I'm excited to keep watching.
Mm-hmm.
All righty. That'll be it for us. Here on The Christian Artist. You can find all the links in the liner notes if you want to find out more about us. But I think that's it. We're out. Go watch Porco Rosso. Porco Rosso. Why is it so hard to say that?
That's so hard for you to say that. It's really easy for me to say
it. See you guys.